The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Context of white supremacy, Gus T. Renegade. We are live, even though we are about 5 minutes early. So it is Thursday. It is book club time. James Lowen, Sundown Towns, part four. We will have our normal setup for the broadcast, intro and all. I'm only coming on a little bit early just because, wow. I don't know if Ivy is listening yet. I guess if you're listening to the archives, you'll get it all. For the people who listen live, you will have missed kind of the preface to the broadcast. But I think Ivy asked some time ago, feels, or she said, it feels like we are losing Gus to yoga. The yoga studio is on the plantation. That is the best answer to that question. The yoga studio is on the plantation, and this week has been an extraordinary reminder of that in so many ways. I mean, wow. And in fact, the cows radio program has been pulled literally into the yoga studio. Cow's guest gave a presentation, Anna Brown Griswold, at the yoga studio, where I have taken 600 yoga classes. And because of that volume, I know, you know, I won't say everybody, but I mean a substantial number of people who teach and or practice at that studio. You know, 600 classes is 600 classes. And wearing "Please treat me like I am a white person," all 600 of them. Or wait, for a few of them of late, I have worn my Cow's yoga retreat shirt with the Klansman on it. The Coonman, gotta love it. But wow, there probably will be programs plural to explain all of this. It's been exhausting, frustrating. Tackiness abounds. The tackiness absolutely abounds. But yeah, it'll be a lot to discuss about that. I can only say, I think in some degree, we'll have to see how things go, but I think it might be constructive because it has allowed me opportunities to talk and write about white supremacy, racism, and to do so in the exact same manner that I do so on this here program. It has emphasized for me the importance of integrity, meaning being committed to your counter-racist code. White people are dedicated to practicing racism, white supremacy, and victims need to be equally dedicated as much as possible. No cutting corners or half-stepping about counter-racism. This everything that has transpired over the last 10 days could have been dramatically, would have been, I suspect, dramatically different if I were not codified. If it was just to come on air and pretend to be codified for a little while and then, you know, I'm kicking it with all of my white friends at the yoga studio. I think I said before, I wear that shirt. Please treat me like a white person. Sometimes I wear it as a reminder to Gus T. Yes, you have to show up even on the yoga mat as Gus T. Renegade, because the yoga studio is on the plantation. And I can even connect to this book One of the patterns of racism, white supremacy that James Lowen talks about is that whites deliberately hide information about how they practice racism. That is a key aspect of what has been happening at the yoga studio as well that I am looking forward to address. Wow, it's been incredible to be. I cannot emphasize the magnitude of the last 10 days and should be more to come. Should be even more dialogues where Gus T gets to talk to even more white women about white supremacy, racism, and how they are the backbone of white supremacy, racism. They have been the core obstacle to my whole experience as a yogi. But that is a key point of James Lowen's book, Sundown Towns, Whites Lying, Deliberately Obscuring When They Have Purged Negras from a Geographic Location. And then they come back and cover all of that up and pretend, lie, that racism, white supremacy, white terrorism was not the reason that this took place. Now we'll get to the real broadcast. Context of White Supremacy, Sundown Towns, Part A. This is the real beginning of the program.
With First Baptist Church, and immediately adjacent to the church was the Wilmington Light Infantry Building, which at the time was the New Hanover County Library. But the Wilmington Light Infantry still maintained a room in that building, and in that room was the guns they used in 1898, including the machine gun, which I used to play with when I was a kid. When I'd go to the library, and there would be members of the Wilmington Light Infantry in that room, or Red Shirt Militia in that room, I would go in there and listen to them talk about 1898 and how they had pulled off the coup and how they had killed hundreds and hundreds of people and how, you know, they had taken over. And the words they used was, "We put them niggers in their place."
People here, they wouldn't talk about it. You know, it was almost like post-traumatic stress or denial. No one really would talk about it. And I had a older cousin. She wouldn't talk about it. Only thing she would say was that it was not about what's been written.
What really brought 1898 out was the Wilmington 10. I don't think if it hadn't been for the Wilmington 10, it would have still been a secret. Because in researching the Wilmington 10, you bump into 1898. You have to. You have to bump into 1898. It was the civil rights issue after the assassination of Martin Luther King. Of course, after the assassination of Martin, when Martin Luther King was killed in April of 1968, there was racial violence and burning and looting and rioting in over 100 cities. So when this Wilmington 10 thing came up, it was a big deal. There were high school students who were boycotting the school because they had closed down the black high school in Wilmington. And what happened was they started meeting at this church, and the Ku Klux Klan came by the church shooting at the church. Okay. At the children who were inside. These were children inside the church, and most of them left after that. Right? It was 4 days of racial violence. Two people were killed, almost $1 million worth of damage, if you count today's money, right? But what they didn't count on was arresting Ben Chavis, who was highly intelligent, who had connections. And he started alerting all these people about what had been done. They arrested, a year after 1971, 1972, they arrested some people who later became known as the Wilmington 10. In the process, you had to look at the history of Wilmington. And when you looked at the history of Wilmington, you found out that the town is almost synonymous with racial violence.
Context of White Supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, March 28th, 2019. So I have been told. This is our fourth installment James Lowen, suspected race soldier, Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism. We're picking up on the section, Creating All Black Towns. The audio segment that you heard at the beginning, that was from one of the best documentary films I have ever seen, Mr. Christopher Everett, Wilmington on Fire. He was a guest on the program, Mr. Everett, at the end of 2015, December. We talked about the film. That audio clip is a little portion of the documentary, which is outstanding. You should definitely check it out if you have the time, but it is just further corroborating evidence of what this book is about. Dedicated white terrorism, whites banding together to use violence to maim, kill black people, theft of property, and purging them from a specific geographic location. Wilmington just happens to be in North Carolina. Mr. Scotty Reed. With that, we'll go ahead and get started. We're on the chapter Creating All Black Towns, Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism, audio segment number one.
Creating All Black Towns. During the Nadir, African Americans were hardly passive victims. They thrashed about, trying tactic after tactic to deal with America's increasing racism. One was the development of all-black towns. It's a matter of semantics, I suppose, whether these towns were an alternative to the Great Retreat or part of it. Certainly, they were founded at precisely the same time. Some commentators have interpreted the black town movement as a giving up on white America. On the contrary, black towns such as Nicodemus, Kansas, Boley, Oklahoma, and Mount Bio, Mississippi, emulated white towns. Indeed, their initial development was marked by a sense of self-respect and competition. They wanted to outdo white towns. They also hoped to provide employment and political opportunities not available elsewhere. Black towns ran their own post offices, which therefore hired African Americans, even when the Woodrow Wilson administration was shutting blacks out of this work. Black towns ran their own precincts, which therefore let African Americans vote, even as the outside society was shutting blacks out of politics. To be sure, black towns were founded in a difficult, even dangerous period. The movement began in reply to the end of Reconstruction in the South, when African Americans were no longer voting freely and lynchings were increasing. In 1879, African Americans began an exodus from Mississippi and Louisiana to Indian Territory and Kansas, trying to find freedom and peace. In 1887, hoping to avoid the worst of the racist storm, African Americans founded Mound Bio in former swampland in the Mississippi Delta. In 1904, African Americans in Indian Territory founded Boley. Both towns grew rapidly, fueled by a wave of optimism similar to that at the end of the Civil War, tinged this time with desperation. By 1908, Boley had 2,500 residents, two banks, two cotton gins, a newspaper, a hotel, and a college, the Creek Seminole College and Agriculture Institute. Briefly, Boley competed with Okemah, Waleka, and Henrietta, nearby white-majority towns, for economic and political influence in the area. Unfortunately, the history of Boley and its neighboring towns shows that black towns offered no real solution to the increasing racism of the Nadir. Gradually, Boley's residents themselves realized they were to have no real chance at social, economic, or political rights owing to forces outside their town and beyond their control. In 1907, whites merged Indian Territory into the new state of Oklahoma. Democrats took over the state and passed vicious segregation laws modeled on Mississippi's 1890 Constitution. Although the research has yet to be done by historians and sociologists in Oklahoma, I believe it'll show that a wave of small expulsions swept through many Oklahoma towns shortly after statehood, as white Democrats reveled in their newly realized power over African and Native Americans. Boley is located in Okfuskee County. Okemah, the county seat, had been founded as a sundown town in 1902. From time to time, African Americans moved in, only to face violent opposition. In January 1907, for example, whites dynamited the homes of the only two black families in town. Later that year, Okemah businessmen leased a building and set up a hotel for African Americans who traded with local merchants or had to attend court and couldn't always get back to Boley by sundown. By April 1908, it was doing a brisk business, which ended when other whites placed a heavy charge of dynamite under the front wall of the hotel. "The building was badly damaged," wrote Okemah resident W.L. Payne. "Farmers living 8 miles from Okemah were aroused by the terrific blast. This brought about a quick reduction in the Negro population of Okemah." Henrietta, the next town to the east, went sundown in December 1907. According to the history of Okmulgee County, a number of black families, perhaps as many as 200 people, lived in one area of Henrietta. Just south of town lived another 30 or 40 black miners and their families. On Christmas Eve, James Gordon, African American, tried to rent a rig from Albert Bates, white, who owned a livery stable. Bates refused, an altercation followed, and Gordon shot him. A posse soon caught Gordon a mile east of town and brought him to the jail. Whites were incensed. They surrounded the jail, battered down the door, smashed the jail lock with a sledgehammer, and dragged Gordon across the street to a telephone pole, where they hanged him and riddled his body with bullets. All the next day, Christmas Day, there were rumors of black uprisings, according to the county history. The talk on the street was that no more Negroes will be allowed to domicile in Henrietta. Within a day or two, the whites rallied together with guns, rocks, bricks, anything and everything, and ran the other black families out of town. "We didn't care where they went and don't know," said one irate resident. From then on, Henrietta was off limits to blacks, except for business during the day. Then Democrats eliminated Boley as a voting precinct and forced citizens of Boley to vote in a smaller town 12 miles away. Boley voters turned out in droves and compelled the whites running that precinct to let them cast ballots, which Democrats then didn't include in countywide tallies anyway. In 1910, Democrats amended the Oklahoma Constitution with a grandfather clause that set up literacy requirements to keep African Americans from voting. Whites were exempt so long as their ancestors could vote in 1861. Blacks' grandfathers, being slaves then, couldn't vote, so the combination took away the ballot from African Americans while granting it to European Americans. Residents of Boley still hoped they could just mind their own business and run their own affairs. But whites weren't satisfied with merely excluding African Americans from voting. In Biddle and Geis's words, "Not only would all avenues of political expression be cut off, but all avenues of social and economic expression as well." White neighbors set up farmers' commercial clubs, the express purpose of which was to drive the Negro farmers from the area and to replace them with white farmers. Pacts were drawn up between whites in which each agreed to withhold employment from Negroes. With each dreadful development, the Negroes attempted to reorganize their ethic for yet another time. But this reorientation became patently vapid, and the Negro community simply relented in the face of white hostility. In 1911, Okemah residents lynched a mother and son who lived in the black community outside Boley, showing that a black town provided no safe harbor from white vigilante justice. The drop in cotton prices in 1913 finished the job. Now Boley started to lose population. The economic and political setbacks added up to almost total disillusionment on the part of the Okfuskee County Negroes. There would be no growing respect and admiration from white neighbors, and no industrial and agricultural prosperity. Boley still holds its annual celebration, but it became a shell of its former self. Its pariah status, conferred by the all-white towns nearby, sapped its morale. Black townships. Sprinkled about the United States, often located at the edge of sundown towns or a few miles away, are other smaller black communities, most of which never incorporated, many with dirt roads off the beaten path. They're the flip side of sundown towns, places to which the excluded have retreated to live, yet close enough to nearby white towns to work. I call them townships because some of them resemble South Africa's black townships, those gatherings of shacks built by squatters that supply maids for Johannesburg's white households and janitors for its industries. Like Tukuza and Soweto, in America, often these were haphazard gatherings of ramshackle houses, many of which were not, until recently, served by amenities such as city water. Some still are not. If even independent black towns succumbed to the demoralizing effect the increased racism of the Nadir had on African Americans nationally, townships showed much less heritage of black pride. They too offered some refuge from the racist storm, but they never made any pretense of providing a solution to America's racial inequality. The little area that housed African Americans adjoining Eugene, Oregon, during World War II was dubbed Tent City because its houses consisted of tents pitched over wooden frameworks on wooden floors. To some degree, these communities resemble reservations, places to which whites restricted African Americans whose labor they desired but whose presence they didn't want. Their residents knew it. Chevy Chase Heights was an unincorporated community located just north of the town of Indiana in western Pennsylvania. In 1960, when college student Ralph Stone studied Chevy Chase Heights, he elicited only scorn when he asked a clerk at the Indiana Chamber of Commerce for information on the community. "Who in the world would want to know that?" she replied. Asked if she at least had population figures for the community, she replied, "Nobody knows. If you want to know, go out and count them." Chevy Chase residents repeatedly petitioned Indiana for annexation so that they could have streetlights, paved streets, and city sewage lines, and the settlement, for geographical reasons, should be part of the borough, according to Stone. But Indiana wants nothing to do with Chevy Chase, he concluded. Indeed, Indiana made this clear long before 1960. Local historian Clarence Stephenson quotes a Works Progress Administration source telling that the black families that formerly lived in the borough of Indiana were asked by the borough council to locate in Chevy Chase. By 1960, according to Stone, 20 African Americans remained in Indiana, and about 577 lived in Chevy Chase Heights. Even their names sometimes imply the racism that was their reason for being. For years, the Colony was the name used by blacks as well as whites for the mostly African-American community south of Cullman, Alabama. A librarian in Cullman explained, "The only full-time African-American residents of the entire county through most of its history have lived in a tiny community called the Colony, which is roughly 20 miles south of the city. The Colony was incorporated as Colony in 1980. African Americans who worked as maids and handymen commuted into Cullman in the mid-1950s by carpools. The Colony had an elementary school, but before Cullman schools desegregated in 1970, African Americans who wanted to go to high school had to go to another county. Culp, Illinois, a majority black hamlet 1 mile west of Herron and 3 miles north of Carterville, began as Number 9 Mine, a coal mine that employed African American miners. White miners called it Nigger 9. Understandably taking offense, citizens of Number 9 Mine incorporated in 1915 as Culp, named for John Culp, the mine owner who employed them. But Herron residents think Culp is short for colored people, and thus mounts no challenge to white sensibilities. Now that mining has wound down, Culp residents work in Herron. But for years, Herron residents informally threatened them with death if they remained overnight, and they couldn't set foot in nearby Carterville even during the daytime. Residents of Stumptown, a small African-American community in western Illinois, worked in Warsaw, but had to be out of there by nightfall. Residents of other sundown towns across the Midwest and border states simply called the little black townships near them Nigger Town, while its African-American residents struggled to have them known by more specific and less demeaning terms, including Little Africa in southern Illinois. Metropolitan areas, too, have their black townships. Suburban Long Island alone has 13. For that matter, many residents of sundown suburbs have long relied on maids and gardeners who commute from inner-city ghettos, which are analogous to black townships. Some suburban black settlements date back to the 19th century. Others grew after World War II, when white suburbs likewise exploded. Typically, black townships supplied workers for nearby suburbs that wanted maids and gardeners but didn't want African Americans to spend the night. Often they were located in floodplains or next to railroad tracks, just outside the city limits of the nearest suburb. In 1966, sociologists Leonard Blumberg and Michael Lally identified 60 of these communities, which they called little ghettos in the suburbs. Most of these communities were unincorporated or didn't enforce their zoning ordinances and building codes, which allowed African Americans to build their own homes, keep chickens and even pigs, and thus create rural pockets in urban areas. Over time, however, as blacks were not allowed to live in incorporated suburbs, the stigmatized nature of the townships as permitted locations for negatively valued population, to use Blumberg and Lally's formulation, became apparent to all. Geographer Harold Rose calls them black colonies in the metropolitan ring. Not only African Americans, but also other deviants were often confined to these black townships. In the 1950s and 60s, Culp had a regionally famous house of prostitution. It still has a thriving bar. As early as the 1970s, the Chevy Chase Heights Community Center hosted monthly gay dances. In the 1960s, the Elks Club and Sadler's Bar in Chevy Chase Heights were perhaps the only places in Indiana County where whites and blacks might socialize and even dance together. Indeed, within black towns and townships, race relations were often good. In Chevy Chase, a man is treated as a man regardless of color, said Fred Johnson, Black Elks Club member in 1960. In Indiana, a white man is treated as a man, but a colored man is treated as an animal. Residents of sundown towns usually put down whites who socialized or lived in nearby black townships as white trash. At the same time, whites in sundown towns often drove to nearby black townships to buy alcohol during Prohibition. For decades, Lock, a Chinese township in California founded in 1915, supplied gambling, prostitution, and opium to residents of Sacramento. Today, locations in black inner-city neighborhoods play the same role for whites from sundown suburbs seeking illegal drugs. Unincorporated townships such as Stumptown and Chevy Chase Heights, and black ghettos for that matter, have no police forces of their own. White sheriffs and police chiefs often wink at deviant or illegal behavior in black townships, as it fulfills three functions at once in the white community. It relieves the demand for the deviants, which usually involves victimless crimes like drinking, gambling, buying drugs, and buying sex. It avoids arousing the forces of priggery because the behavior doesn't take place in neighborhoods they care about, hence isn't salient, and it further stigmatizes both the black township and African Americans in general. Alternatives to the Great Retreat. The Great Retreat to the larger cities of the North and West and to black towns and townships was not African Americans' only response to the wave of increasing white hostility they met during the Nadir. But there was no good answer. Following Booker T. Washington's advice to cast down your buckets where you are and seek only economic advancement, foregoing political and social rights didn't work. White Southerners sometimes lynched successful black businessmen and farmers simply because they were successful. Following the counsel of W.E.B. Du Bois, and pursuing voting rights and full citizenship led to such fiascos as the Ocoee, Florida riot described in Chapter 7, in which whites drove out the entire black population and converted Ocoee to a sundown town. We've seen that moving to small towns in the North became difficult as more and more of them went sundown. Emigrating to Indian Territory, which at first promised a more tolerant multiracial milieu, led to the overt racism of Oklahoma after 1907, including sundown towns such as Okemah and Henrietta. Going farther west didn't work either. An African American in Denver lamented in 1910 that what he called the onslaught against the race had reached Colorado, even though the Mexican, Japanese, Chinese, and all other races are given a chance. Giving up hope for America, the author wrote, "We are leaving in great numbers to the far Northwest, taking up claims in Canada." But Canada offered no real refuge. It considered closing its doors to blacks entirely. African Americans in Boley and in many interracial towns joined the Back to Africa movements organized by Chief Sam and Marcus Garvey. The popularity of these movements didn't derive from any developments in Africa, but was another aspect of the Great Retreat, prompted by the white racism exemplified in the Sundown Town Crusade. The movements organized by both Sam and Garvey ended in disarray, partly because they expressed pride and despair more than actual intentions to emigrate. The Great Retreat was no solution. We've seen that forming black towns and townships offered only partial relief. So did moving to large cities, which increasingly segregated their African-American residents into constricted ghettos and marginal occupations. Despair seemed to be the only answer to the hatred of the nadir. Still relevant were the old slave spirituals such as "Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen." Certainly, the Great Retreat didn't improve race relations. Regardless of how sundown towns were created, the whites within them only became more racist. They almost had to rationalize having forced or kept non-whites out. Writing about Omaha, Howard Chudikoff points out another reason. Because African Americans increasingly lived in separate neighborhoods, whites no longer had the benefit of knowing them individually, so they fell back on thinking stereotypically about them as a group. The lack of familiarity bred suspicion and resentment, which burst during the riot of 1919. Chudikoff concludes, "Clearly, the experience of Negroes resembled those of no other ethnic group. Every white ethnic group experienced, and even chose, residential concentration during their initial immigration to the United States. Thereafter, as the years passed and they became more Americanized, their residential concentration decreased, precisely when it was rising for African Americans. As the years passed, African Americans found themselves more and more isolated, increasingly barred from towns, suburbs, and neighborhoods. How did this happen? How were sundown towns and counties and neighborhoods created? What were the mechanisms by which so many towns became all white, or, in the case of suburbs, created themselves that way? The next chapter tries to answer these questions." Chapter 4, How Sundown Towns Were Created. An article in the July 14, 1902 New York Times reads, "Negro Driven Away. The Last One Leaves Decatur, Indiana, Owing to Threats Made." The last Negro has left Decatur, Indiana. His departure was caused by the anti-Negro feeling. About a month ago, a mob of 50 men drove out all the Negroes who were then making that city their home. Since that time, the feeling against the Negro race has been intense, so much so that an anti-Negro society was organized. The colored man who just left came about 3 weeks ago, and since that time received many threatening letters. When he appeared on the streets, he was insulted and jeered at. An attack was threatened. The anti-Negroites declare that, as Decatur is now cleared of Negroes, they will keep it so, and the importation of any more will undoubtedly result in serious trouble. A Fine History by Jean Swaim of Cedar County, Missouri, provides a detailed example of the process that took place in many of the counties summarized in the previous chapter. Cedar County is located between Kansas City and Springfield, Missouri. African Americans had lived in the county since before the Civil War, originally as slaves. In the 1870s, a black community grew up within Stockton, the county seat, including a school, candy store, and a park with a popular croquet court, where white Stockton men often spent their Sunday afternoons competing in tournaments. Some African Americans worked as domestic help, others at a local brickyard. By 1875, whites and blacks had organized the Stockton Colored School, which eventually had as many as 43 students. A newspaper account from August 1899 shows interracial cooperation. About 1,500 attended colored people's picnic here. Order was good, except for a few drunken whites. Stockton won the ball game from Greenfield, 20-1. Greenfield's colored band was a big attraction. African Americans also lived elsewhere in the county, including Little Africa near Humansville, in the northeastern corner. 40 families lived there, with a church, school, and store. They held an annual picnic on the 4th of July, to which whites were invited, and had a baseball team with a white coach. Then, something bad happened. Something that the local histories don't identify, and that has been lost even to oral history. As another local historian, born in the county in the 1920s, put it, "It's just a dark history that nobody talks about." Speaking of the event or chain of events that ended Cedar County's racial harmony. Around 1900, the county's black population declined precipitously from 127 in 1890 to 45. Whatever prompted the initial decline, we do know why it continued. Cedar County was becoming a sundown county. By 1910, only 13 African Americans lived in the county, and by 1930, just one. Swaim refers to many shameful incidents in which visiting ball teams, travelers, and even laborers were told to be out of town by night. Blacks could find haven in Greenfield, the seat of the next county to the south. She tells of a black bricklayer whose work attracted admiring crowds. Not only was he paving El Dorado Springs' main street in perfect herringbone pattern, as fast as an assistant could toss him bricks, but he sang as he worked and moved in rhythm to his song. Nevertheless, he had to find a place out of town at night. In Stockton, prejudice was still rampant in the late 1960s, Swaim continues, as black workmen constructing the Stockton Dam were provided segregated and inferior housing west of town. Their visiting wives cooked for them. Is Cedar County still sundown today? Swaim writes, in the 1990s, few blacks are seen in Cedar County. But the 2000 census counted 44 African Americans. One black couple lives in El Dorado Springs and seems to get along all right. Nevertheless, Cedar County in 2005 has yet to reach the level of black population and interracial cooperation that it showed in the 1890s. Swaim's fine account, summarized above, provides the texture of the great retreat from one Missouri county. But neither Swaim nor the other historian quite say how it all began. The initial how in Cedar County may be lost to history by this point. But in many other places, we do know how counties and towns went sundown, or how they were created that way in the first place. This chapter examines a variety of methods by which town after town across America excluded African Americans, mostly after 1890. We begin with violence because it was the most important. Moreover, threat of violent force underlies many of the softer methods: ordinance, informal actions by police and public officials, frizzing out blacks from social interaction and from institutions such as schools and churches, buying them out, and other forms of bad behavior by white residents of the town. By dint of these methods, independent sundown towns were created, mostly between 1890 and 1930. Sundown suburbs were created a little later, mostly between 1900 and 1968, by a panoply of methods, among which violence and intimidation were also prominent. Creating sundown towns by violence. Often, white residents achieved their goal abruptly, even in the middle of the night. In town after town in the United States, especially between 1890 and the 1930s, whites forced out their African-American neighbors violently, as they had the Chinese in the West. Decatur, in northeastern Indiana, went sundown in 1902, as told in the excerpt from the New York Times. Adams County, of which Decatur is the county seat, wound up without a single black household. A century later, it still had only five. Decatur exemplifies a widespread phenomenon. Little riots, most of which have never been written about, even by local historians. These are cases of what Donald Horowitz calls the deadly ethnic riot. He cites examples from India, Kyrgyzstan, Malaysia, Nigeria, and other countries, and defines the form as an intense, sudden, though not necessarily wholly unplanned, lethal attack by civilian members of one ethnic group on civilian members of another ethnic group, the victims chosen because of their group membership. Members of one ethnic group search out members of another. The search is conducted with considerable care, for this is violence directed against an identifiable target group. Towns with successful riots wound up all white, of course, or almost so, and therefore had an ideological interest in suppressing any memory of a black population in the first place, let alone of an unseemly riot that drove them out. Whites also tried to cleanse at least 15 larger cities of their more substantial non-white populations. Denver, of Chinese, in 1880, Seattle, of Chinese, in 1886, Akron, in 1900, Evansville, Indiana, and Joplin, Missouri, in 1903, Springfield, Ohio, in 1904, 1906, and again in 1908, Springfield, Missouri, in 1906, Springfield, Illinois, in 1908, Youngstown, Ohio, and East St. Louis, Illinois, in 1917, Omaha and Knoxville, in 1919, Tulsa, in 1921, Johnstown, Pennsylvania, in 1923, and Lincoln, Nebraska, in 1929. They failed mainly because the task would have taken 3 or 4 days, giving their governors time not only to call out their state's National Guard, but also to realize they would get considerable criticism, and so would their state, if they failed to act. Some of these larger riots received some attention, including books and historical markers. Since they were unsuccessful in that they failed to drive out all African Americans, they've left fuller records of the process, because interracial communities have no need to deny that they had once had a black population. As well, they have black populations with their own collective memories. Indeed, in Tulsa, an ongoing controversy concerns reparations. But most of the little riots have gone entirely overlooked, and as a result, the pattern of widespread ethnic cleansing, of which these failed large attempts represent the tip of the iceberg, is not generally understood. Moreover, even when the cleansings were incomplete, they made a profound impact upon surrounding towns, often inspiring satellite riots. Consider the 1903 attack on the black community in Joplin. As was often the case, it started with an act of violence against one white person, in this case, the murder of a police officer. There was little doubt that the assailant was a black tramp named Thomas Gilliard, who was quickly taken into custody. Several hundred white people then gathered outside the jail, broke through the wall, and lynched him after a tug-of-war with other whites who tried to stop it. Then the mob went through black neighborhoods, attacking African Americans, burning their homes, and cutting firemen's hoses so they couldn't intervene. Half of Joplin's 770 African American residents fled for their lives. Joplin was large enough that the mob couldn't drive all African Americans from the city. But the results are still plain. In 2000, Joplin had a lower African American population proportion, just 2.7%, than it did in 1902. Moreover, this riot, along with several others in Missouri and Arkansas, helped foment an ideology of ethnic cleansing that made most of the Ozark Plateau a sundown region by 1920. Another unsuccessful cleansing, in Springfield, Illinois, had a still greater impact. In 1908, residents of Springfield acted on their desire to have an all-white city. A white woman, Mabel Hallam, claimed George Richardson, an African American, had raped her. Police jailed him, whereupon a mob gathered at the county jail to lynch him, along with another black prisoner accused of murder. The sheriff borrowed an automobile from businessman Harry Loper, however, and managed to get both prisoners safely out of town. Angry at being foiled, the mob destroyed Loper's restaurant and then turned its rage on the African-American community in general. According to Roberta Seneschal, whose book is the standard source on the riot, during 2 days of violence, white rioters gutted the Capitol's black business district, left blocks of black homes in smoldering ruins, and lynched two innocent black men, Scott Burton and William Donegan. The rioters' ultimate goal, seemingly, was to drive away all of Springfield's blacks, Seneschal concluded. The task was simply too large, however, since Springfield in 1908 had about 3,100 African Americans in a total population of 48,000. Nevertheless, some 2,000 did flee the city. Only the belated arrival of the Illinois State Militia kept the mob from finishing the job. Springfield being the capital, the state government simply could not ignore this riot. The Springfield riot was famous briefly throughout the world, not because it was unusual, which it was not, but because it happened in Abraham Lincoln's hometown. Springfield's history encapsulates America's downward course in race relations from the Civil War to the Nadir. When Lincoln's funeral train brought his body back to Springfield for burial in 1865, a regiment of black troops led the procession to the state capitol. Thousands of African Americans had journeyed for days in order to be in Springfield at the funeral, according to an officer in the military escort for Lincoln's body. Afterward, some of them stayed on to live in the city. Now the townspeople of the great emancipator were trying to expel them all. "Abe Lincoln brought them to Springfield, and we'll drive them out," shouted members of the mob. After the riot, Hallam admitted she made up the story about being raped to cover up an affair she was having. Nevertheless, Most Springfield residents showed no regret, except about failing to drive every last black person from the city. The tree from which the mob hanged Scott Burton, a black barber, was hacked to pieces to make souvenirs of the occasion. After the riot, some employers fired their black employees, and many local shopkeepers now refused to serve African Americans. Later, 107 people were charged with crimes. But the only person sentenced was a man convicted of petty theft for stealing a sword from a National Guardsman. No one was ever convicted for murder, arson, or any other crime against an African American. The Springfield riot stands as a prototype for the many smaller riots that left communities all white between 1890 and 1940, most of which have never been written about by any historian. Indeed, the Springfield riot itself spawned a host of imitators. Whites shouted, "Give 'em Springfield!" during attacks on African Americans as far away as Alton, Illinois, Evansville, Indiana, St. Louis, Missouri, and the Cumberland Plateau in Kentucky and Tennessee. Closer to home, the Illinois State Register reported, "At Auburn, Thayer, Verdon, Girard, Pawnee, Spaulding, Buffalo, Riverton, Panna, Edinburgh, Taylorville, Pleasant Plains, and a score of other places in central Illinois, a Negro is an unwelcome visitor and is soon informed he must not remain in the town." Some of these towns, such as Verdon and Panna, were sundown towns before the Springfield riot. Their exclusion policies had merely become newsworthy owing to the riot. Others, such as Buffalo and Pleasant Plains, excluded African Americans in its aftermath. Neither the local, county, state, or federal governments ever brought anyone to justice for any of these expulsions from smaller towns. Buffalo, a little town 12 miles east of Springfield, became all-white on August 17, 1908, 2 days after the National Guard ended the Springfield riot. Not to be outdone by Springfield, whites in Buffalo posted the following ultimatum at the train station: "All niggers are warned out of town by Monday, 12 noon sharp. Buffalo sharpshooters." Its black population fled, and since then, Buffalo's been all white. Today, some whites commute from Buffalo to Springfield because they feel Springfield is too black. Springfield was 15% African American in 2000. In addition to the small town disturbances around Springfield in 1908, at least a score of other towns in Illinois alone became sundown through violence. Whites in Romeoville in northeastern Illinois expelled all the town's African Americans in June 1893, in a pitched battle in which 8 people were killed. Other violent expulsions include Beardstown at an unknown date, East Alton and Spring Valley in 1895, Verdon in 1898, Panna in 1899, Carterville in 1901, El Dorado in 1902, Anna Jonesboro in 1909, West Frankfort in 1920, probably Pinckneyville in 1927 or 1928, and Vienna in 1954. Additional possible violent expulsions in Illinois that I've not confirmed include Newman back around 1879, Lacon and Toluca between 1898 and 1910, Granite City in 1903, Coal City at some undetermined date, and Ziegler by mine explosion in 1905. A series of at least 6 race riots in the Ozarks, along with smaller undocumented expulsions, led to the almost total whiteness of most Ozark counties, which continues to this day. In 1894, Monette, Missouri, started the chain of racial violence. As happened so often, it began with a lynching. Ulysses Hayden, an African-American, was taken from police custody and hanged from a telephone pole. Although Murray Bishop, an authority on Monette, believes him innocent of the murder of the young white man for which he was hanged. After the lynching, whites forced all African Americans to leave Monette. Pierce City, just 6 miles west, followed suit in 1901. Again, a crime of violence had been perpetrated upon a white person. And again, after lynching the alleged perpetrator, the mob then turned on the black community, about 10% of the town's population, and drove them out. In the process, members of the mob set fire to several homes, incinerating at least two African Americans inside. Some African Americans fled to Joplin, the nearest city, but in 1903, whites rioted there. 3 years later, whites in Harrison, Arkansas, expelled most of their African Americans, and in 1909, they finished the job. In 1906, whites in Springfield, Missouri, staged a triple lynching they called an Easter offering. No one was ever convicted in any of these riots, which sent a message that violence against African Americans wouldn't be punished in the Ozarks. On the contrary, it was celebrated. In Springfield, for example, souvenir hunters sifted through the smoldering ashes looking for bits of bone, charred flesh, and buttons to carry away with them in order to commemorate the event. Local drug stores and soda parlors sold postcards containing photographs of the lynching, and one enterprising businessman had medals struck commemorating the lynching. One side of the medal read, "Easter Offering," and the other side, "Souvenir of the Hanging of Three Niggers, Springfield, Missouri, April 15, 1906. The immediate effect was a contagion of ethnic cleansing that drove African Americans from nearby towns such as Cotter, Arkansas. Sociologist Gordon Morgan wrote, "It's entirely possible that the trouble that was experienced in Boone County, Harrison, affected the black populations in surrounding counties. The census shows precipitous drops in black numbers in the 1900 to 1910 decade in Carroll and Madison counties, both of which adjoin Boone." Elsewhere in the United States, I've been able to confirm many riots that forced out the black populations from at least 30 other towns, including Mayaca City, Florida, Spruce Pine, North Carolina, Wareham, Pennsylvania, Ravenna, Kentucky, Greensburg, Indiana, St. Genevieve, Missouri, and North Platte, Nebraska. Many of these mini-riots in turn spurred whites in nearby towns to have their own, thus provoking small waves of expulsions. Creating sundown towns by threat. Sometimes just the threat of violence sufficed, especially where whites were many and blacks few, as in Buffalo. For that matter, because the historical record is incomplete, we can't always know when violence or mere threat of violence forced a town's African Americans to leave. Most mass departures were probably forced by at least the threat of violence. Why else would everyone leave at once? Sometimes expulsions were more gradual, taking several years, and requiring repeated threats or acts of violence. When one member of the black community was lynched, all African Americans took that as a threat to their continued well-being. Often they were right. Frank Quillen, whose 1913 book, The Color Line in Ohio, stands as an oasis of honest scholarship during the arid Nader period, observed that after a lynching, such as in Akron, Galleon, and Urbana, Ohio, I found the prejudice much stronger than it was before the lynching, and the Negroes fewer in number. A lynching, by definition, is a public murder. Those who carry it out don't bother to act in private, since they believe the community will support them. Thus, a lynching becomes a community event in which all whites participate, at least vicariously, because the entire white community decides not to punish the perpetrators. After such an event, whites grew more likely to engage in such everyday practices as forcing African Americans from jobs like postal carrier or locomotive fireman, as well as from entire communities. The increasing frequency of mass spectacle lynchings in particular played a major role in the spread of sundown towns. These events, often announced in advance, drew hundreds and even thousands of onlookers. Typically, in their aftermath, not only was no one brought to justice, but also whites reveled in the brutality, selling fingers and bits of the victim's flesh as souvenirs, and making postcards of photos of the event to send to friends across the country. Such events, reasonably enough, convinced African Americans in many towns that they were no longer safe. Chapter 7 tells how a spectacle lynching in Maryville, Missouri, not only caused African Americans to flee that town in 1931, but also led to their departure from neighboring counties. Mena, Arkansas, had a small African American population until February 20, 1901, when Nigger Pete was lynched. Pete was considered by many locals to be insane, according to a 1986 article based on newspaper accounts of the time. He'd gotten into a fracas with a 12-year-old white girl, knocking her down and injuring her quite badly. Later in the evening, Pete was arrested and placed in jail, as has often been done before in similar offenses. The episode flashed across town, and it soon created strong feelings against the Negro. Whites then lynched him. They shot him, fractured his skull, and cut his throat. No one was ever apprehended for his death. According to an article written in 1980, the black folks began to leave Polk County after the Nigger Pete lynching. The county's African American population, 172 at one point, dropped to 12 in the aftermath, then slowly dwindled to zero as the remaining few died or moved away. Does this qualify as a violent expulsion? The African Americans obviously felt threatened. They also knew that 2 years earlier, whites had posted notices around Mena warning blacks to leave. On that occasion, other whites, including the mayor and newspaper editor, denounced the threat, but it had to have been unsettling nonetheless. Moreover, the editor had said then, "The number of Negro citizens in Mena is very small, and as a whole exceeding well-behaved. As long as these facts remain true, they have their rights as citizens, and the city officials will take any necessary steps to protect them." Pete's action, given White's penchant for holding the entire African-American community responsible for the misstep of any individual, threatened the premise undergirding white forbearance and prompted the expulsion. According to Shirley Manning, MENA historian, my father said he was only a boy of 5 to 7, born in 1897, when people of Polk County ran all the blacks out of town. And as they left from the racetrack, white people set the wagons on fire. My dad died when I was 10, but I remember the story, and my much older brother has told it to me also. So in MENA, at least, threat of violence crossed over into actual attack. Many other towns saw their African-American populations leave suddenly after one member of the group was lynched. On February 10, 1918, for example, whites in Estill Springs, Tennessee, lynched G.W. Litch, an African-American minister. 2 days later, in a spectacle lynching, they burned another African-American alive before 1,500 spectators. Black residents of the community were forced to watch, according to Stuart Tolney and E.M. Beck. After the incident, the black population of Estill Springs quickly disappeared. The lynching of an African-American by whites from Toluca and Lacon, north of Peoria, Illinois, in 1898, probably led to the exodus of African-Americans from those towns.
Context of white supremacy. So we'll pick up the next chapter or next section, the role of the Ku Klux Klan. Picking up. Context to white supremacy, the number 641715-3640, the code 564943, pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641715-3640, the code 564943, pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Before we get started, one of the few times I will say this, I don't think I have taken more notes during a Cal's book club session than I have today during session one. So for today, folks who have read the book and suspected race soldier, James Lowen, the author of the book we are reading, Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism. It seems he may have left a comment on Black Talk Radio Network with the internet and all the shenanigans and deception of white supremacy. Might not be him, but Mr. Lowen might be aware that we are reading his book for the book club, so we should be extra sharp as we listen and critique the text. But for today, I have a lot of notes. I think there were a lot of important tidbits, so if you did not really listen to the text, if you weren't listening and you just want to give, you know, anecdotes or irrelevant commentary, if you could save all of that, people that we would like to hear from to give analysis, if you actually either read on your own and or listened to be able to respond to the actual text that we heard, that is really what we would like today. 641-715-3640, the code 564943, pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I'll try and read some of the comments that people have written in as we go. And again, do any of the listeners, especially if you've been listening for all four sessions, do you have any thoughts about the narrator and how they're impacting what we're hearing, or just thoughts about the tone, sound, quality of the reading, narration? Folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, may I be heard?
We'll get retired firefighter first and then Mr. Demley Ford.
I would just answer the question, try to answer the question that you asked. He seems to be, I mean, he's pretty clear, you know, coming in. Sounds like a professional. Sounds like his voice is one of those white-styled reporter type of thing that comes on television or the radio during the time when you listened to the radio, they had voices, and you had to have some sort of particular type of voice. And I think the narrator is one of those type of has one of those type of voices that's quite clear. And basically, what I hear him doing is just basically running categorically down the different incidents of murder and mayhem registered onto non-white black people. Almost categorically, you know, and primarily in the late 19th century late 19th century to early, I would say probably the first two decades of the 20th century is where he's at right now. I mean, it's easy to follow. It's pretty easy to follow as far as that concern. And that's my attempt to answer that question.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Mr. Demery Ford, did you have commentary you wanted to share, sir?
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Yes. Greetings, Gus, and to the other callers and listeners, retired firefighter, and Ivy and the other ones that's listening. to answer your question first, it's good that you asked that, because this guy will put you in the mind, it seems as though it's James Loren that's reading it. You know, it just put you in the mind that it could actually be him. And then it seems like the guy's putting a lot of emphasis on areas that, you know, he himself would have put the emphasis on. But, it's quite a coincidence. I mean, and someone would probably think that was him actually reading. You know, and one thing that I noticed about the author, when he's given these anecdotes of, you know, what happened when the whites were being terroristic and running blacks out of town, he gives the impression that there was always a warning. And, you know, we can just assume that there was, you know, the majority of times there was no warning. And then how could it be a warning? Now, the last we heard, I guess, was a whistle, you know, for blacks to get out of town. But, I mean, if a 90 or over 70% of all of the suburbs and towns were white only town, you know, I guess the black people would, you know, just know by proxy, or, you know what I'm saying? How would you know if they don't actually put up a sign that, you know, you're not welcome here, unless you just assume you're not welcome any place by all whites? And then that would create, that would give a reason for creating all black towns, which he gave the impression that the black towns may have been created in order to compete, or that maybe they gave up on white people. And I think that black towns were created out of necessity for people to meet their basic needs and not be terrorized and harassed at every turn. when he first started out talking about thrashing about God, that's why I thought that words were important, because, you know, thrashing, okay, now you're being terrorized, but every attempt that you make, your tactics you use, you just thrashing about. You just, I guess, like on the floor, just, you know, wiggling around, or however the definition. But I guess in a sense that we are contained, and then any attempt to make any form of independence or whatever would be looked at like you were thrashing about. You know, it's actually a strategic tactic to try to make your life, give you more quality of life. But another thing, the term the author was using about townships, you know, comparing to South Africa, that may have been an act of racism. When they were referring to the blacks on page 83, in Henrietta, that was run out. They used everything, guns, rocks, bricks, any and everything, he said. But the most important thing about that, they did this on Christmas Eve. And it just brought up the religion of white supremacy. And you have to relate this, because even later in the reading, when it was a triple lynching, the term they used was a Easter offering. So you can see that it's something diabolically sinister about the spirituality of racism, white supremacy. So, and then any acts of defiance or where blacks would try to defend themselves was just acts, call one a deadly ethnic riot, and then an unsuccessful cleansing. Yeah, I think all these are acts of racism. And then the white woman, Mabel Harlem, who claimed George Richardson had raped her, which we heard that before, is consistent. And almost every book we read on racism, that makes the white woman instrumental in the implementation of racism. She's an intricate part, and even recanted and said that it didn't really happen after it was over. But of course, you know, a lot of times, you know, the victims were already riddled with bullets or hanging from a tree. Then the author, one last thing, told a story of somebody. I guess it was she's a historian now, but she was 5 years old, and somebody told her a story about how they run blacks out of town and set the fire on the wagons when they was on their way out. And that's the way you bring up a future racist. You get them started early, you know, tell them about how it's 1,000 for the white supremacist, zero for Negroes. I'll rest my line, Gus. I'm muted. Thanks for taking a call.
Much obliged, good sir. Any other folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Folks listening with the live stream, I got disconnected briefly, but was able to get reconnected without too much of an interruption. But we should be all back, good to go. Well, not good to go, but, you know, all things considered. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed. Wow, folks. Abby, yes, ma'am. Greetings, Abby.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to the retired firefighter and Mr. Demi Four and all the rest of the callers on the line. Man, the gentleman from 2 weeks ago who talked about how The author's tone is just this, you know, this hopelessness, like there's nothing that you can do. I got that impression, especially this week when he was talking about the resistance, and he was talking about how they just, he almost said those exact words, that it was just nothing that they could do. And that's not true back then, and it's not true now, despite the major challenge that we face. He called their terrorism bad behavior. He referred to their terrorism as little riots and mini riots. That reminds me of the term microaggression. Like that's an oxymoron. Like, that's a contradiction in terms. Like, how do you have a little riot? How do you have a microaggression? If it's aggressive, it's not. There's nothing small about it. If it's a riot, it's not little and it's not many. And I thought the exact thing that Mr. Demery Ford brought up was the religion of white supremacy. When they said the Easter offering, like, oh my. And Nigger Pete, that name, it reminds me of Nigger Jim. From, I believe, Huckleberry Finn. And just the last thing I wanted to point out, it was something that was said in the book earlier that I do not remember what it was. Man, that's bothering me, but I want to move on to the last thing that I was going to say. Like, man, whites are just real, real savages. I mean, hanging people from telephone poles, dynamites, triple lynchings, as Mr. Demery Ford pointed out, and just driving these black people out of town and telling them where they can and can't live and threatening them and beating them and murdering them and oh my goodness. I mean, it's just, and even when he said, last thing I'll say, even when he said that they hung business owners just because of the fact that they were successful, that reminds me of Tulsa, Oklahoma, because when they burned that to the ground, they hung the business owners. And that was it. I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Yes, ma'am. Context of white supremacy. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. So, last week, we had folks who wrote in, additional callers who wrote in. Or I didn't even get to all the points from last week, so I left off at number six. Number six, the section creating all black towns. This section reinforced to me the concept that there cannot be a community in a global system of racism, white supremacy. Even when black people attempted to form their own community, in quotes, they were completely at the susceptible to the power of racist man and racist woman. Number seven, black townships, they too offered some refuge from the racist storm, but they never made any pretense of providing a solution to America's racial inequality. This passage struck me as overtly racist by the author. The author blames the victims of these horrific acts for not providing a solution. These are people who simply are trying to survive dire circumstances. To refer to these acts of terrorism as America's racial inequality seems to minimize the issue. That seems to be a pattern in the critiques. Number eight, for years, the colony was the name used by blacks as well as whites for the mostly African-American community south of Coleman, Alabama. This passage reminded me of an experience I had several years ago in the 1970s. I was dating a black female who lived in one of the inner suburban areas of Cleveland, Ohio. One summer evening, we drove through one of the outer scenic suburban areas. We were stopped by the local police and asked, "Do you live in the allotment?" I was totally unfamiliar with the term, but fortunately my companion was, and she was able to negotiate the situation without creating a problem. Later, she explained that the allotment was an area in which the white people of that suburb allowed black people to live. Finally, the question for me is whether the terms colony, Indian reservation, ghetto, concentration camp, South African township, internment camp, and allotment are essentially synonyms for areas in which racist white supremacists force or allow their non-white victims to live, enabling racist man, woman, and child more efficient means of subjugation to varying degrees. Much obliged for the commentary. Again, you can email untiljustice@gmail.com if you want to share, and we'll read as we proceed. I took more notes. I'm going to try to read as quick as I can. I'll not be able to share them all. And I didn't even get all my notes from last week. I thought this was important. This is from last week. He said the Arkansas and Illinois deadlines may still be in effect. As recently as 1992, a black friend said, "I can't go into that town," to reporter Jack Tichenor, T-I-C-H-E-N-O-R, when he proposed buying a bag of charcoal after dark in Karnak, just north of the Illinois deadline. Now, this is the illustration to show that racism, white supremacy, still exists in this part of the country, Arkansas, Illinois area, that a black person can't go over here and buy a bag of charcoal. Now, this is, in quotes, what the portion that I, oh, wait a minute, it's not. It's not in quotes. But presumably, this is in an article, because there's a footnote, that this is a black male talking to a reporter about racism still being a problem. And no way, I can't go over there to even buy a bag of charcoal. Out of all of the illustrations that you have, it just happens to be a black person talking about buying a bag of charcoal, when black people have been called charcoal as a racist slur for years. Even they have sometimes where instead of the ghetto, that'll be the coal pile. They had that. That's a term where they would allow the Negroes to sit at the baseball stadium. That would be the charcoal section. All right, now we can get to this week. creating all black townships. I think that's the first one from this week. No. Black townships from this week. Hardly passive victims. I think that was brought about last week. Someone asked about illustrations of black people fighting back. It just seems to be a lot of black people being brutalized and they don't resist or fight back or anything. Thrashed. I think Mr. Demery caught that word. I did too. When I think thrashed, I think of an animal thrashing about like a horse stuck in the mud or something like that. I don't think of a person. And the interesting thing is, if you look up the definition for thrash, the first definition that you get is to beat an animal, to thrash or punish someone. You need a good thrashing. And then it goes to give more definitions. But that use of that term stood out. And then the use of the term great retreat. Or rather, when he's talking about these all black towns, whether or not this is an alternative to the so-called Great Retreat or a part of it, all of this is a response. All of this is just evidence, symptom of racism, white supremacy. If there were no system of white supremacy, you wouldn't have a black part of town or a black town. None of that would even make sense if you did not have a system of white supremacy. And just going to that word community, I'm so glad so many listeners pointed that out. Next, anytime you're in a system of white supremacy, it's tinged with desperation. Let's see, next. Mr. Fuller, born in Oklahoma, I thought of that repeatedly while reading this text, would be interested in hearing his thoughts. To religion of white supremacy. I said that a few times in reading the checks. Oh, my goodness. The lynching of James Gordon, where they snatch him out. The whites were incensed on Christmas Eve. They break into the jail and they lynch him on a telephone pole. Cal's decade, 10 years, context of white supremacy. Eula Biss was a guest on the program in 2009, Notes from No Man's Land, July 2009, no less. We talked about her book. She said she wanted to write a book on the history of communication, and she was looking at the construction of telephone poles, and she got totally distracted from that and ended up having to write a book on racism because of the number, the frequency of times that she was researching telephone pole construction, and it ended up being a lynching. where there weren't enough trees around, so they just used the telephone pole to lynch a nigger. You can go back 2009. She was a guest on the program. I thought of that immediately. And in fact, I stopped to check her book to see if this particular lynching was mentioned in her book. It was not, but she emphasized there were so many of them, just like, you know, Mr. Lowen has with this book, that you couldn't, you know, possibly lynch them all, mention them all. Let's see. Next. I thought it was important that the farmers' commercial clubs were set up with the express purpose dedicated to driving Negro farmers from the area and to replace them with white farmers. And they set up PACs to withhold employment, like total dedication, all areas of people activity. I mean, it's rare that you get it spelled out so explicitly, but I mean, this is the same thing that they do right now, 2019, but to have it written out that, oh yeah, this is our goal, and this is how we're going to coordinate all of our efforts in all areas of people activity to achieve this goal. Oh, that's not it. Let's see. Him using the term black community, I thought was incorrect. And then right beneath that, he's talking about in 1911, Oklahoma, he says, showing that a black town provided no safe harbor from white vigilante justice. He puts justice in quotes. That's one. It's white terrorism. Be correct with don't even pretend to give the facade of justice. Call it what it is. Why the reluctance to label white violence terrorism? Act of racism on the part of Mr. Lowen, I suspect. Next. Oh, my goodness. The passage where he says, I got to read the whole thing. So this is from Black Townships. He says, even independent black towns succumb to the demoralizing effect the increased racism of the Nadir had on African Americans nationally, townships showed much less heritage of black pride. I don't even know what that means. I'm accustomed to playing the black and proud button for black people. I don't know ever in the 10-year history of the cows, I've had to play the black and proud button for suspected race soldier. But what are you even talking about, Mr. Lowen, if you are listening or aware that we're reading your book? Black townships showed much less heritage of black pride. I don't even know what that means. In a system of racism, white supremacy, you don't have communities. All of this, townships, black towns, independent black towns, any of this, all of this, as I said before, these are not communities. These are just little, you know, whatever you want to call them, results of racism, white supremacy that racists, as he said, can efficiently come and tear down, blow up whatever they want, whenever they feel like it. That's not a community. That's just a little huddle of very pathetic, helpless victims. I would qualify with the same title today, 2019. But townships showed much less heritage of black pride. No idea what that means. And that just seems like something a racist would write. He uses the word community a lot in this section as well. Let's see, next. Nigger Nine, Stump Town. I thought that was important, the way that these towns are deliberately named to reinforce the racism, white supremacy. And it's throughout that this is like a national thing, that's just Niggerville, Niggerburg, Niggertown. Let's see. Oh, my goodness. This is the best description. It's not Niggertown. It's not although I think that is better than saying that this is a black town. This is an independent black town, or this is an independent black city, or this is a black community. I would much rather, instead of people saying community, that this is Nigger Nine or Niggerville or Niggerburg, because that makes it explicit, like, oh, whoa, this is just a collection of niggers. Now we don't have any confusion. These are not powerful people. These are victims of racism. Oh, okay. Got it. That's accurate. That's much closer to thinking in a correct, logical way in a system of white supremacy than pretending that this is a community. But he says, over time, however, as blacks were not allowed to live in incorporated suburbs, the stigmatized nature of the townships as permitted locations for a negatively valued population. That's fact. That's not a community. That is a, what it, let me, because they got it in quotes, permitted locations for a negatively valued population, to use Bloomberg and Lely's formulation, became apparent to all. Geographer Harold Rose calls them black colonies in the metropolitan ring. I don't think that one's as accurate. It's permitted locations for a negatively valued population, a victimized population. And there we go. If you are confined to someplace, that's not a community. And that's black people, non-white people worldwide are still confined to wherever racist allows to be. That's not a community. Oh my goodness. The section where he talked. Now, I said before, one of the ways that he's practicing racism in this text by submitting that whites, racists in the North, didn't want contact with black people. And I said then, that's nonsense. Whites always, always, always want to rape, take advantage of non-white people. Maybe that means I don't want to live with you. Maybe that means we don't have any niggers live in our town, but you can believe Niggerville, Niggerburg, we know all of the locations where we can go and rape and pillage and do what we do, because that's how they operate worldwide. I said that was a major act of racism. And then lo and behold, we come this week. What does he say? He starts talking the Chevy Chase Heights Community Center hosted monthly gay dances. I said, wow. To include that Chevy Chase's Niggerville, that's why I said make it plain so we know which is the Niggerville and which is racist sundown place. So Chevy Chase Heights is Niggerville and they got monthly gay dances. I said, wow, that's interesting that that would be highlighted. That's a highlight. That's a feature of Niggerburg. And I also thought Delectable Negro, the subtitle, Homoeroticism and Human Consumption in U.S. Slave Culture. Homoeroticism. You don't think the whites knew about the gay dances in Niggerville? I mean, Chevy Chase Heights? Continuing, this is all in the same paragraph. In the 1960s, the Elks Club and Saddler's Bar in Chevy Chase Heights were perhaps the only places in Indiana County where whites and blacks might socialize and even dance together. Cowbell. Indeed, within black towns and townships, race relations were often good. Act of racism, white supremacy, in my view. There's that word again, 94 times. It's in the book. That is absurd. Are you going to tell me that within townships? No. So that within Niggerville, that's why I said, give it to me correctly. So in Niggerville, race relations are good. Whites and blacks get along okay in Niggertown. Mr. Lowen, you're practicing white supremacy racism deliberately, I suspect, in the book, if you are listening. Talk straight, because these are all his words. That's not a quote to say that race relations were often good. Even using the term, come on, it's terrorism. Next. when he talks about all of the trash and filth that they put in Niggertown, and that's great, we can go over and rape the black people and get all the drugs and rape the black children and dump all of the fornication and vice in their area. And that gets destigmatized in the niggers. And we keep it out of our areas. And he says today locations in the black inner city neighborhoods, it's not a neighborhood, that's Niggerville, play the same role for whites from sundown suburbs seeking illegal drugs. I thought that was extremely important, should be emphasized. And then he says all of this fulfills three functions at once in the white community. That's the only time that word should be used. In my view, Mr. Lowen and any white person uses it anytime that they refer to a non-white area as a community, that is an act of racism, because that's probably where we picked up thinking that we have a so-called community. He says it fulfills three functions at once in the white community. It relieves the demand for the deviance, which usually involves victimless crimes like drinking, gambling, buying drugs, and buying sex. It avoids arousing the forces of priggery because the behavior does not take place in neighborhoods they care about, and hence is not salient. And it further stigmatizes both black townships, Niggerville, and African Americans in general. All very important tidbits, I thought. Let's see. Wow, I took a lot of... Oh, and I got to get the footnote on this one. Let me stop and get the footnote on this one, because this wasn't... So if you don't have the book, if you don't read closely, you don't get the footnote. So what was the footnote for this one that I had to even go and highlight? So the footnote on this one, bang. According to historian Lee Bushbaum, email 2003, prostitutes, all of whom were black, could only be patronized by white customers. I think that should have been the main body of the text. I think most people know when you read a book, you're not going to read the footnotes. I would hope Cal's listeners don't do that. You miss a lot. So I'll back up and read that one again. This is footnote 106. Well, it's, yeah, I have to give you the exact, because, you know, footnotes restart with each chapter. So I'd have to give you the exact chapter. According to historian Lee Bushbaum, this is from a March 2003 email, prostitutes, all of whom were black, could only be patronized by white customers. Black men were not even allowed in the building day or night. The sheriff never challenged the arrangement so long as he was paid off. Footnote 106. This is all about Culp. All about Culp. Not only African-Americans, but other deviants were also confined to black townships. In the 1950s and 60s, Culp had a regionally famous house of prostitution. And that's what I mean. If it's regionally famous, that means you got Niggerville and race soldiers come from all over to take advantage of. This one happened to be black females. I'm sure they had a similar arrangement for black males, both children, whatever it is. But all over, and black males are not allowed in the establishment day or night. I think the man, not race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood. Okay, so back to the main body of the text. Let's see. Oh my God. When I think Ivy mentioned that there was no fighting back, it was just a sense of overwhelming and what can you do? The Great Retreat was no solution. Now, to me, this seems like he is saying that black people making these townships is also a retreat, that they are retreating to form their own areas. In my view, that is an act of racism. It can't be that racists had a Great Retreat, so-called, and purged black people and made all white sundown towns. And then the victims of racism also had a quote unquote Great Retreat to make all black towns. No, you had racists purging black people and making areas where Negras are not allowed to be. And then in that process, they also set up nigger towns, not townships, not black communities. This is not black independence or any of that nonsense that is confusing and deception. Nigger towns set up by race soldiers. Next, he says, despair seemed to be the only answer to the hatred of the nadir. Still relevant were the old slave spirituals, such as "Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen." Are you serious? Are you serious? Like, there's no mention of any resistance at all. Isn't this the time of Ida B. Wells Barnett? That's what I was thinking when he mentioned black business owners being lynched. That's exactly what she said. She was a contemporary of this time period, talked about all the violence. Why not a quote from her directly? That's someone who was fighting back, resistance, who was not just going around singing "Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen." Like, come on, James Long, this would be another one. Instance of deliberate racism, white supremacy. And I was reading this like, oh, wow, I could see why white people would like this, like to have a presentation like that. Continuing. I just keep going from act of racism to act of racism. So then he said, this is all on the same page. He says, writing about Omaha, Howard Chudikoff, I guess, points out another reason. Because African-Americans increasingly lived in separate neighborhoods, whites no longer had the benefit of knowing them individually, so they fell back on thinking stereotypically about them as a group. The lack of familiarity bred suspicion and resentment, which burst out during the riot of 1919. That is utter, total racist nonsense and deception. That makes absolutely no sense at all to say that the problem, the reason that whites practiced racism or had an increase in racism, white supremacy in any way, shape, or form, is because they didn't have sufficient contact with niggers. That is an embarrassment for someone to even present that with a straight face. You had formal plantation slavery. It couldn't get much closer. We're raping niggers and bragging about this, the slave coast. If that's taking place and that hasn't convinced you to behave correctly, well, then I don't know what it's going to take. All of that. That's why I say, Mr. Lowen, you're practicing racism, white supremacy. That's why I took so many notes, because there are pieces that I learned They had to write that down. And then lots and lots of instances where, wow, I think this white author is practicing white supremacy racism deliberately and back to back. And that is a major one, because that sort of nonsense is given on a regular basis, which leads to, we just need to have more contact so that whites will know that niggers are not niggers and will treat them correctly. Continuing. Humans, I thought it was so important. You got Niggertown, Niggerville, Nigger Nine, Stump Town, not a full tree, but a stump, something that has been castrated. Welsing moment, even. Stump Town, that's where the niggers are. And then you got Humansville, where the whites are. That's what they called it, Humansville. I'd be curious if anyone wants to look. Does Humansville still exist? Then something bad happened. I've been talking about this all week with the yoga studio, that white people practice racism, white supremacy, and they excise, they obfuscate, they sterilize, they redact, so that the white supremacy is practiced, it's expunged, and then there's no record, just something bad. Or sometimes it's not even something bad happened, just, oh, never was any niggers here. What do you mean? Yeah, we always had this piece of property. What are you talking about? Niggers? No. Never been any niggers here. Sometimes it'll just be that frequently it will be that in a variety of different ways, but just total erasure of their act of racism, white supremacy. Let's see. Next one, he says, Cedar County in 2005 has yet to reach the level of black population and interracial cooperation that it showed in the 1890s. I have no idea what interracial cooperation is in a system of racism, white supremacy, and even that word suggesting that there are more than one race. Let's see. I thought it was an important act of racism that Donald Horowitz, this is not James Lowen, Donald Horowitz, but James Lowen is culpable too, because he's citing the study. They give a definition of what a deadly ethnic riot is. And the examples that they choose from are India, Kyrgyzstan, Malaysia, Nigeria. They pick a lot of areas with a lot of non-white people. The superlative example of what they call ethnic rioting, purging, whites. I just thought that was important, that these examples would all be from areas with a lot of non-white people, or predominantly non-white people. Little riots, I think, victim, I had the same thing, the minimizing. I just, when he was talking about the case with Thomas Gilyard, who was lynched, but they said the assailant was a black tramp named Thomas Gilyard. I paused on that, with whites writing the history. There's no idea. Thomas Gilyard could have been, you know, a business owner, a farmer, a father, anything but a tramp. But with them in charge, that's just how it gets recorded. He's a tramp, and that's that. I think it's important to even have a question as you proceed. Inspiring satellite riots, I thought that was important. The cutting of firemen's hoses, that's come up so many times. That came up in The Warmth of Other Suns repeatedly. Whites, act of terrorism, burning down black people's property, killing black people, fire officials come out to put out the blaze, and the racists are cutting the fire hose or obstructing firefighters from doing their job. Let's see. The man not, we had the white woman making up stories. The religion of white supremacy, there were so many instances where they hacked up a black male's body. They said the tree from which the mob hanged Scott Burton, a black barber, was hacked to pieces to make souvenirs of the occasion. That is the religion of white supremacy. And again, the man not, or excuse me, the delectable Negro. That's the one I mentioned, meant to mention. They had, oh my goodness, the religion of white supremacy again. What did they say in Arkansas? Arkansas expelled most of their African Americans, and in 1909, they finished the job. In 1906, whites in Springfield, Missouri, staged a triple lynching they called an Easter offering, religion of white supremacy. On the same page, Ulysses Hayden, an African-American, was taken for police custody and hanged from a telephone pole. Again, Yule Abyss, that's what she said, shifted the chapter or the title, the focus of her book. Man. celebrating violence against black people. I put that also into religion of white supremacy. I have one more section of notes, but I will. Yes, I'll stop there. Then any other folks have commentary at all? If any of the notes that I shared didn't make sense, feel free. But any other folks have commentary before we get to audio segment number two? Oh, wait a minute. The person that dialed in,
yes.
Last four digits, 6260. Did you have commentary? 6260.
Hi, guests and guests. You was talking about, you wanted to know if there's still a town called Humidsville. I just researched it, and there is, Wikipedia said there's a town called Humidsville, Missouri. Humidsville is a city in Polk County, Missouri, United States. As of 2010 census, the city population was 1,048. It is a part of Springville, Missouri, metropolitan statistical area, and the mayor is Paula Johnson, is the current mayor. And what it's saying for the history is saying that Humidsville was named after an African-American Indian named James Human, who settled in the area in 1834. A post office called Humidsville has been in operation there since 1839. And there's some more information on it, but I'm not going to read it. And then also I looked up Niggersville. And yes, there was a place called Niggersville. It's now called Negusville for the Ethiopian, for Negus. And they're saying that it's a small NPC village. I'm not sure what NPC means. It's north of Utagangar City. I'm not sure what country this is in. Apart from a village, it only consists of a blacksmith and two butchers. The village is accessed by a rail station, a rail transit network. The village is also an important junction where line goes to Old Newport, Courseville, and Cowville. And this is what's interesting about the article here that I see. It says, Panzanari, Butchaton, and Victoria are towns built near Niggersville. And although both now outside the NPC village, Niggersville do receive some additions. Apart from the train station, is a watermelon farm and a fried chicken restaurant has been built. All these towns are interlinked with the cobblestone roads and together form what is called by Tudor and Molester, which is those, I guess, some of the from the creators of the town, the northern region. And that's all I wanted to share.
Much obliged. Thank you kindly for the research. Let's see. We retired firefighter. Can you get your commentary in about 60 seconds?
I'll try. I'll start off what you mentioned about Mr. Fuller, Muskogee, Oklahoma. I haven't heard him in specifics about the lynchings, but he did mention about an instance when he was in grade school, and in turn, I guess during that time, children were warned and counseled by the principal, which was going to be a non-white black person, preferably probably a male, about calming down in reaction to, in this case, it was a black male who was shot to death by the police. He mentioned about that. Last but not least, I also wanted to emphasize on how the author is not really doing a good job at stating on how well organized white people were and still are in their means to mistreat us. As you listen to the readings, you would hear the same procedures over and over and over again. I used the word last week, military, and I don't want to use the word military to substitute the word racist or white supremacy. I'm just stating it from the standpoint of a method. And this is synonymous with white people and the way they do things all over the world.
30 seconds.
All over the world. And that's all I say. That's all I say for right now. Since I heard you say 30 seconds, I have further comment. Thank you.
For sure. We'll be sure to get you once the second audio segment concludes. A little bit lengthier today, but hopefully constructive info. This is Mr. James Lowen, suspected race soldier, Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism, audio segment number 2.
The role of the Ku Klux Klan. The rise of the KKK after 1915, the so-called Second Klan, often amounted to an implicit threat to blacks in largely white communities. In many towns across the North, from Maine to Illinois to Oregon, Klan rallies in the 1920s drew more people than any assemblages before or since. On August 20, 1923, for example, 8,500 members of the Ku Klux Klan met 2 miles east of West Frankfort, Illinois, a gathering equal to the town's entire population at the time, and inducted 400 new members. A 1925 Klan rally near Montpelier, Vermont, drew nearly 10,000, almost twice that city's population. Such huge gatherings gave whites a sense of power, a feeling that they could do whatever they wanted to African Americans, and sometimes to Jews and Catholics as well. West Frankfort was already a sundown town, but in towns with black residents, these monster demonstrations had a chilling impact on the few and scattered African Americans who knew their safety depended upon white goodwill. In Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, for instance, local historian Sally Alberts believes the KKK was instrumental in driving the blacks away. In the early 1920s, the Klan held a Klan vocation at the Fond du Lac fairgrounds. Newspapers claimed that 5,000 people marched in the parade. Subsequently, several crosses were burned in the areas where the blacks lived in the city. The earlier sense of possibility for African Americans in Fond du Lac, the welcome meal, the rooms at the hotel described in the previous chapter, had been replaced by a sense of terror. Sometimes this implicit threat became explicit. The Klan played a direct role in making some Oregon towns all white in the 1920s. In Medford, Klansmen took George Burr, a boot black, to the mountains, placed a noose around his neck, hung him from a branch, then cut him down and ordered him to leave town. He did. In Oregon City, 6 masked Klansmen confronted car wash owner Perry Ellis, the only black man in town, accused him of sleeping with a white woman, and nearly lynched him. Ellis moved to Tacoma, Washington, and Oregon City had no black household thereafter until the 1980s. Creating sundown towns by ordinance. Under the thrall of the white supremacist rhetoric of the nadir, many towns passed ordinances to prohibit African Americans from being within the corporate limits of the town after sundown, or forbade selling or renting property to them. As with sundown towns themselves, actions against Chinese Americans led the way. Several authors tell of ordinances in the West banning them. Eureka, in Northern California, passed its ordinance informally at a large civic meeting on February 14, 1885, the day it expelled its large Chinese population, nicely showing the link between violence and ordinance, and didn't repeal it until 1959. Reports of ordinances against African Americans began to surface after about 1900. I collected oral and written history from 25 towns in Illinois that have a tradition of such ordinances. In 1965, Donald Royer did a small study for the Indiana Civil Rights Commission, checking out 19 Indiana towns with oral traditions of having passed sundown ordinances. He couldn't find any on paper. Between 2000 and 2004, I collected oral and written history from some of the same towns, finding the tradition still vibrant, and added another town. I also found evidence of sundown ordinances in 22 other towns, in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Kansas, Nebraska, Iowa, Missouri, Wisconsin, Tennessee, Ohio, and Maryland. In California, for example, historian Olin Cole, Jr. tells how the Civilian Conservation Corps in the 1930s tried to locate a company of African-American workers in a large park that bordered Burbank and Glendale. Both cities refused. The reason given was an old ordinance of the cities of Burbank and Glendale, which prohibited Negroes from remaining inside municipal limits after sundown. Most of these towns, especially in the Midwest, were not close to any black population concentration and wouldn't have confronted any inundation by African Americans had they failed to pass an ordinance. Consider DeLand, for instance, a small village in central Illinois, population 475 in 2000. Present and former members of the DeLand Board of Trustees agreed in 2002 that it had passed such an ordinance decades ago. DeLand never had more than a few hundred inhabitants and isn't located on any major railroad or highway, so it never faced an influx of non-whites. Why, then, did it enact such a law? Since by the 1890s, African Americans were defined in American culture as the problem, passing such an ordinance seemed prudent, the progressive thing to do. Towns that took similar actions were up to date. DeLand is in Piatt County, whose county seat, Monticello, was also a sundown town and also has a tradition of having enacted an ordinance. I suspect DeLand followed Monticello's lead, and I believe that a wave of these ordinances swept the Midwest somewhere between 1900 and 1930. I have yet to find the text of a single Midwestern ordinance, however, so I can't follow their spread via a written and dated record. Ordinances, legal or illegal? It turns out that these ordinances were all illegal. Again, action against Chinese Americans in the West led the way, in this case in a positive direction. In 1890, Chinese Americans challenged in court a San Francisco ordinance that required them to move outside the city entirely or live in an area set aside for slaughterhouses and other businesses thought prejudicial to public health or comfort. In the words of John Noonan, summarizing In re Lee Sing, the plaintiffs won. The ordinance was declared unconstitutional. In 1910, Baltimore passed a residential segregation ordinance. Quickly, this was seen as the thing to do, and similar ordinances followed in Winston-Salem, Birmingham, Atlanta, Richmond, Norfolk, Louisville, New Orleans, St. Louis, Dallas, and other southern and border cities and towns. The Louisville Ordinance became a test case. it designated city blocks with a majority of African Americans, black blocks, and those with a majority of whites, white blocks. Blacks were not allowed to move into white blocks, and vice versa. These ordinances were drafted to look equal so they could pass muster under the 14th Amendment. As historian T.J. Woofter, Jr. explained, although theoretically the law is supposed to apply to white and colored alike, in practice it never does. The colored people do not protest against the white invasion, while the white people in mixed blocks do not hesitate to protest. Altogether, about 50 cases have been made against Negroes under the New Orleans Ordinance, and there has not been a single case against a white person. In 1917, in Buchanan v. Warley, the U.S. Supreme Court held the Louisville Ordinance unconstitutional. White civil rights lawyer Moorfield Story argued the case for the NAACP. In 1917, no plea for black rights would have been likely to prevail. Story won because a white right was at stake, the right of a white seller to sell his house to the highest bidder, even if that person happened to be black. The court held that the ordinance destroyed the right of the individual to acquire, enjoy, and dispose of his property, in violation of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. Although Buchanan ruled unconstitutional a law intended to create sundown neighborhoods, there can be no doubt that as a precedent, it would also invalidate ordinances intended to create sundown towns, which didn't hide their explicit anti-black intentions behind even a gloss of fairness. In November 1915, Mayor J. R. Voight introduced a segregation ordinance to the North Chattanooga City Council in Tennessee. Mayor Voight was aware of the ongoing constitutional challenges to such a bill, similar ordinances having already been declared illegal in Winston, North Carolina, and Richmond, Virginia. He phrased the measure even-handedly. Section 1. It shall be unlawful for any colored person to move into and occupy as a residence, place of abode, or to establish and maintain as a place of public assembly, any house upon any block upon which a greater number of houses are occupied as residences, places of abode, or places of public assembly by white people than are occupied as residents, places of abode, or places of public assembly by colored people. Section 2 then repeated this language, but with the races reversed, so it appeared to be in line with the separate but equal ruling in Plessy v. Ferguson 2 decades earlier. However, everyone knew that North Chattanooga had only 2 black families living in it. Therefore, it had no block upon which a greater number of houses are occupied by black people. As the Chattanooga Daily Times put it, the passage of this ordinance will consequently make the town practically of an exclusively white population. In short, it was a sundown ordinance. To avoid legal challenge, Mayor Voight also built in provisions so that the 2 black families then living in North Chattanooga would not be forced to leave. They got the message anyway, for by the time the ordinance passed, on December 22, 1915, the Daily Times was able to headline its story, "North Chattanooga is exclusively white now." The newspaper was proud to report, "As there are now no Negroes in North Chattanooga, it might be called the only town of its size in the country where the population is exclusively white." Mayor Voight has received many compliments on his segregation ordinance, the story concluded. Despite Buchanan versus Worley, many cities and towns seem simply to have ignored the constitutional issue. Cities kept right on passing them, and as the authors of the Encyclopedia of Black America noted in 1981, a number of these ordinances were maintained long after 1917. Legal attempts to enforce them in the courts were still being made in the 1950s. There's a scholarly tradition in American legal history that questions whether the U.S. Supreme Court can cause, or has ever caused, significant social change. The history of Buchanan versus Worley makes a good case for this theory. Brea, California, offers an example of an ordinance known to be illegal, yet still in force decades after Buchanan. Vincent Jaster, retired school superintendent of Brea, was an educated man who knew sundown ordinances were unconstitutional. He also knew their power, as can be seen in his answer when asked in 1982, "Why would you prefer to live in Brea rather than Yorba Linda, Fullerton, or elsewhere?" "Lower taxes for one thing, better climate, nice people, and good schools." I maybe shouldn't say this, but this was an item some years ago in the 1940s and isn't going to trouble me at all. Brea used to have a law that no black person could live in town here after 6 o'clock. See, Fullerton had its colored section. Placentia at that time was predominantly a Mexican town. But for years there were no black people in Brea at all. The shoeshine man was black, but he had to leave town by 6 o'clock. It was an illegal law, of course, if you had gone to the Supreme Court. No one took Brea to the Supreme Court, so its unconstitutional law was legal so far as its effect in Brea was concerned. The same point held in countless other towns. Why shouldn't towns ignore the constitutional question? After all, during the Depression, the federal government acted as if Buchanan didn't exist, when it set up at least 7 towns, Richland, Washington, Boulder City, Nevada, Norris, Tennessee, Greendale, Wisconsin, Green Hills, Ohio, Arthurdale, West Virginia, and Greenbelt, Maryland, that explicitly kept out African Americans. At the same time, and for 3 more decades, the Federal Housing Administration, a government agency, required restrictive covenants before insuring housing loans. If the United States government, charged with enforcing Buchanan, could exclude African Americans, obviously any community could. Attempts to enforce illegal sundown ordinances in the streets were still being made in the 1990s. In 2001, a Central Illinoisan related that when she and her husband were about to buy a house in Maroa a few years earlier, the realtor told us we wouldn't have any problems with black neighbors because Maroa had an ordinance and they weren't allowed. Indeed, if a seller, agent, and black would-be buyer in Maroa all believe today that the ordinance is legal, in a very real sense it remains in effect, even though it is illegal. Residents will think that selling to an African American violates the law. Some will conclude that it's also wrong. They will not sell to a black, and may take steps to keep others from doing so. As an attorney who grew up in Martinsville, Illinois, a sundown town, put it, "If you say there's an ordinance, then whether there was or not, that gives it the color of law." Even an unconstitutional ordinance connotes to the residents of the sundown town that the black would-be newcomer is not supposed to be here, especially if those residents don't know that the law is illegal. whether legal or not, and even whether actually passed or not, belief in the ordinance puts it in force. Indeed, residents in some Midwestern towns think their sundown ordinances are still in effect. Creating sundown towns by official government action. Even without enabling legislation, many municipal and county officials drove out or kept out African Americans by formal policy. Discussing Crawford County, Indiana, historian Emmalou Thornbrough tells of a contractor for the Louisville, New Albany, and St. Louis Railroad who hired a gang of colored construction workers. White residents warned him that they would not be allowed to work. When he sought protection from the county officials, they confirmed that it was an unwritten law that Negroes were not permitted in the county. A resident of Crawford County in the 1960s told a similar story about contractors building a different railroad in a later decade who also hired blacks. The sheriff warned African Americans about the law, but this time he allowed them to remain in the county so long as they stayed on railroad property. Accordingly, they lived in tents near the work site. An unwritten law enforced by county officials, including the sheriff, is a law to all intents and purposes. For that matter, an unwritten law enforced by a police chief or sheriff can be even more serious than a written law. Consider this conversation real estate developer Hank Roth had with the sheriff of Graham County in western North Carolina in about 1969. He wanted me to know they didn't have any blacks in Robbinsville. He said the last nigger who came to town hung under that tree over there. Thus, no bright line can be drawn between unwritten understandings backed by official actions and formal ordinances. Towns that posted sundown signs implied they were all white by municipal action. I've confirmed 184 towns in 32 states that displayed sundown signs. Consider the Connecticut town whose sign is "Whites Only Within City Limits After Dark." To the passersby, that certainly looks official. And year after year, no one took it down, after all. Willie Harlan, president of the Washington County, Indiana Historical Society, made this point when he wrote, "It is said there was a sundown sign east of Salem near Canton. Our Historical Society treasurer was born in 1928. She remembers her parents telling about the sign. I don't know whether there was an ordinance posted, or blacks were made to believe there was." Of course, whites too were made to believe there was. Towns that sounded whistles or sirens to warn blacks to get out of town at 6 p.m. also implied they were sundown by official action. Historian David Roediger grew up in Columbia, Illinois, a sundown town near St. Louis. Like Villa Grove, Columbia had a 6 p.m. whistle. Roediger reported that his mother moved to Columbia from Cairo in 1941 to teach elementary school. The police chief almost immediately took her aside to say that she should feel secure, unlike in Cairo, because Columbia had a 6 p.m. whistle to warn blacks out of town. Coming from the chief of police, that's official policy. Jim Clayton, a retired Washington Post reporter who grew up in Johnston City, a sundown town in southern Illinois, wrote, "Although there never was an anti-black ordinance, it was well understood that blacks were not permitted to stay in Johnston City overnight. An ordinance would be superfluous," he suggested, Everyone already knew no African Americans were allowed in town, so why bother saying so? If a black person tried to move into Johnston City in the 1940s, according to Clayton, the chief of police would have told them to leave, and that would have been all it would take. The police chief also played a key role in Batesville, Indiana. According to Judy Tonges of the Batesville Historical Society, from what I can piece together, there was never an ordinance or law in Batesville prohibiting blacks. However, the knowledge was there. I talked with our police chief, who grew up next to a lumberyard. He would visit the black truckers who were delivering lumber. He said they always rushed to get unloaded and out of town before dark. Of course they did, after the police chief visited them. Like Johnston City's, many towns' sundown reputations were so well known that the municipalities felt no need to pass an ordinance. According to a longtime resident of Niles, Ohio, Niles qualifies. I'd be surprised if there were official ordinances prohibiting African Americans from settling here. Things operate here much more informally. Laws and ordinances are irrelevant and unnecessary. Many other sundown town residents made this point about their home communities, large and small. African Americans, or in some cases, Jews or Chinese Americans, were not to live there. Period. It was, and in some communities remains, as simple as that. Written or not, legal or not. In many sundown towns and suburbs, law enforcement officials follow and stop African American motorists to this day as a matter of departmental policy. Thus, we can't assume that towns with ordinances were more racist, more rigid, or more notorious as sundown towns than communities whose officials kept out African Americans without such laws. Creating sundown towns by freeze-out. Sometimes, no specific act of violence or formal policy was required to turn a town or county all white. As the nadir deepened, white churches, schools, and even stores across the North often made African Americans unwelcome. In 1887, in Grundy County, Missouri, for example, a white school that previously had admitted black children now barred them. Their parents sued under the 14th Amendment. But in 1890, the Missouri Supreme Court denied their appeal. Yet 15 black children were required before a county had to have a colored high school. So African American children in Grundy County simply had no high school. It comes as no surprise that the black population of Grundy County fell from 254 in 1890 to just 85 by 1930, 35 in 1950, and 18 by 1960. Historian Robert Nesbitt documented what happened to Pleasant Ridge, a small black community that grew up in Grant County, Wisconsin, after the Civil War. The neighboring white school agreed to take in their children, and in the years after the Civil War, Pleasant Ridge hosted an annual picnic that featured an agreeable mixing of the neighbors. But by the late 1880s, its white neighbors had rechristened it Nigger Ridge and no longer deigned to attend community events such as the picnic. Residents continued the picnic for a few years as a mostly Negro affair, in Nesbitt's words, but Pleasant Ridge went into decline. No specific event forced African Americans out, but Grant County's black population fell from 98 in 1870 to 68 in 1890, 43 in 1920, and just 7, all males, by 1960. To be black in Pleasant Ridge in 1870, when there were 97 other African Americans in the county, was all right, because one also had white friends and neighbors. By 1920, being one of 43 African Americans meant living in a sea of Caucasians who ranged from indifferent to actively hostile. In some towns, whites who still wanted to befriend their black neighbors now felt compelled to do so surreptitiously, lest they too be ostracized by the larger white community. The one black student in the Wyandotte, Michigan public schools in the 1910s had white school friends who were pleased that he didn't embarrass them by recognizing that he knew them when their paths chanced to cross away from school. A woman in southern Illinois told me she played with the children of the black family that lived near them, but only under cover of darkness. Faced with such discouragements, especially in towns and counties where they were few, African Americans could no longer struggle on. So they pulled back into larger cities. At least there, one's pariah status wasn't always right in front of one's face, and one might have friends. No bright line boundary can be drawn between public prohibition and private freeze-out. A mass meeting in Bell City, Missouri, 110 miles south of St. Louis, on December 20, 1939, exemplifies this blurring. Citizens passed 8 resolutions, all dealing with forcing out every African American from Bell City and northeastern Stoddard County, and keeping any new blacks from moving in. The first resolved that all land and property owners be invited, urged, and requested not to permit or allow any Negro or Mexican families or single person or persons to move and reside upon their lands or property in the above-described territory for any purpose whatsoever. Another warned that the moral standard of living conditions will be greatly lowered if Negroes or Mexicans are allowed to inhabit this territory. Resolution 7 was the most ominous. That every Negro family or individual, which numbers some 6 or 8 now residing in said district, be invited to move out of said territory in a reasonable length of time, and that the landowners where said Negroes now dwell be invited to rid their premises of said Negro in a reasonable time. The final resolution invoked officers of the law. Further resolved that all citizens and peace officers in this and adjoining counties are asked to cooperate with this convention and its committees in carrying out these resolutions in a peaceful and lawful manner. Clearly, John Wright, Ben Oakley, Reverend Jones, and committee, who affixed their names to the resolutions and had flyers printed up, official-looking, suitable for posting, thought they would have the law on their side. Apparently, they did. For by 2000, Bell City still had only 5 African Americans among its 461 residents. Yet, just to the southeast lies one of Missouri's blackest areas. Communities that froze out their African Americans might seem at first glance to be kinder than those that forced them out violently or as a matter of law. But as Wyandotte historian Edwina DeWint points out, for such a crusade to succeed requires a general unity of action of all Wyandotte citizens in not renting or selling property to Negroes, refusing to serve them in stores and restaurants, and not hiring Negroes in places of employment. Such unanimity over time might require more widespread anti-black feeling, which Wyandotte had in abundance, and more systematic discrimination than is manifested in a town where a mob suddenly erupts to force out African Americans overnight. Moreover, some campaigns to force African Americans out by firing them were mounted in the 1920s by the KKK or labor unions that also threatened violence. So the intimidation level may have been no lower than in Fond du Lac. Whites who wanted to retain their black employees often found themselves violently intimidated and forced to let them go. So freezing out proves no kinder on close inspection.
Context of white supremacy. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. We'll pick up next week. Procession number 5, James Lowen, Sundown Towns. If you dialed in, pressed *61 and you have commentary, line should be open. We should have 30 minutes remaining in the broadcast. If you did not get to speak at all, do not lollygag. Go ahead, dial in, get your hand up right now so that we can get to you immediately. Let's see, Irie in Louisiana, if you had commentary, you should be with us.
Hi, everybody. Hi, Gus. Hope everybody is doing well tonight. The part where he was talking about it being lawful or unlawful, being a sundown town, it really doesn't matter. It's all about desire. And they desire, you know, not to have any black people in their town whatsoever. And by a certain point in time in American history, it's basically known that discrimination, you know, of any type is so-called outlawed, but again, the will to be racist precedes anything. And I think it's dishonest for him to say, oh, it became, you know, lawful or something that could be enacted just based off of the word of a law enforcement. No, that's, I call balderdash on that. And another thing I wanted to tell everyone and share with you also, Gus, is there's a book. It's kind of middle school to like maybe freshman level, high school level, but it's a book about a young girl named Marika. And it has a longer title, but it's basically about how Manhattan was turned into a sundown town at some point in time when Manhattan, a certain area, was known as the Five Points. And her family did pretty well. They had a boarding house for black sailors, you know, full amenities and everything. The children worked with their mother, who was also a beautician. And I haven't finished the book, but ultimately, from this young woman's journal, she's going to talk about the destruction of her family home during the riots of Five Points, in which they basically, these Irish and whatever other particular section of white Europeans, you know, they started their infighting. They all were basically unified and getting all, as you say, the meat figures out. And that's all I wanted to share. Thank you very much, everybody. And thank you, Justin. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged. Thank you so much for sharing. Yes, if you recall the title, or once you, I guess, get access to the information, you can let us know and we'll check it out. Others that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be, or the other folks who dialed in, *61, if you have a hand up, line should be open.
Ivy here.
Greetings, Ivy.
Did you just mean haven't been heard of from this, from the second part?
Oh, right. You're good.
Oh, okay. I really appreciated Mr. Demery Ford's commentary from the previous section that we had, you know, about an hour ago. I wanted to say that. He mentioned about principle versus practice. I mean, I don't know if he used the term principle, basically what the law is versus how they enforce them. I thought that that was important because that's how it is today. Like, a lot of times people talk a lot about, and they get very confused about that, you know, we need different laws, we need different policies, we need different cops, we need different lawyers, we need different this, different that, different judges, everything else. There's nothing wrong with the laws and the policies. The problem is the practices. Like, there's nothing, there's no law out there that says you can murder black people on videotape, but that's what they do. Which just shows that even just having these laws and all that, it's just nothing but a production. It doesn't mean that white people are interested in correctness at all. As far as he mentioned anti-blackness, I don't believe that anti-blackness exists because I haven't seen any evidence that people are opposed to the color black, that they're opposed to the sky when it gets dark, that black appliances have any problem selling or anything like that. Now, I understand that words like shady and all that, because we've been taught to speak negatively against the color, but I haven't seen any evidence that people actually oppose the color black, and that's a lot of people's favorite color. A lot of people wear that color, all of that. From what I've seen is that there are anti-black people, that is black people that people are against, not the color, and that includes black people who are against black people in general. I appreciate it when you said, I think it was last week, that violence is not just physical. There's all these different things, like the laws and all these different things that they, like he mentioned a lot of different ways to have sundown towns, and it wasn't just direct physical violence. It was threats of violence and things of that nature. All of these different things are violence, just like you said. As far as the narrator, I think I agree with the firefighter with what he said, but at the same time, I find whatever his name is, the narrator, I find him to be stoic in the way that he reads. You would just never know, at least in my view, that this book is about terrorism. You would never know that this is about murdering people to remove them from a particular area and just all the horrible, violent, savage things that have taken place in the way that he reads this. Like, he's no Joe Morton at all. You would hear so many fluctuations in emotion and all of those types of things to fit the different settings and to fit the different things that is being talked about. White friends was brought up. Man, no such thing as that. And they talked about how the white people, they didn't want to be ostracized, so they'd let go of their so-called black friends. I mean, if you love somebody and they're a friend of yours, none of that matters. What it boils down to is that they're not friends of yours. And the last couple of things that I wanted to quickly say is that they talked about just, yeah, it relates to that in terms of them ostracizing you. That to me is evidence that there's no such thing as white inaction. Like, whites are always active, and if they are not active, they are going to have consequences. Like, you must practice racism. Like, you can't just stand by and not do something. You have to do something. You have to be active, whether you defend racism, deny racism, whatever, lose your so-called friends or disassociate yourself from other victims, whatever the case may be, you have to do something, and you are rewarded, which is a much better, more accurate term than benefit. You are rewarded for practicing racism. I just want to say one last thing is that the place Nigeria was brought up, I think I call that, and I think I'm going to keep doing that, I call that niggeria, because I really think that that's what white people mean, and that they're just changing it to Nigeria and Niger and things like that to hide what they're really trying to say. And the same thing for the word ginger. When you talk about ginger ale and all of that, obviously if you you get the word nigger out of that spice. So I just wanted to point those things out, and I'll meet my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Much obliged, Ivy. Love some ginger. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed. Any other comments from the second audio segment? Everybody good? I'll get to my notes.
Yes, can I be heard?
I guess we'll go the opposite way this time. Mr. Dummy Four will get you first, and then we'll get a retired firefighter afterwards.
Okie dokie. all right, yeah, mine'll be real quick. The role of the KKK or Ku Klux Klan seems they've been around forever. And the 8,500 members of the Klan that met in West Frankfort, Illinois, he was saying that the gathering equal to the town's entire population at the time. So, you know, it's like, I mean, what do you do? They going around, hey, you got a Klan meeting tonight, man, be there, be square. You know, the entire population of the town at the Klan meeting. And then something that's absurd is, I guess, yeah, he was saying that the blacks in that particular area, you know, besides being scared out of their wits, they knew their safety depended upon the white goodwill. And as a footnote on 28, I didn't get a chance to look it up. I'm sure that, you know, he probably, I don't know what it says, but it seems ridiculous, because if you in an environment where you've been terrorized, dynamited, set on fire, killed, hanged, riddled with bullets, I don't think the goodwill of whatever handful of white people that may not have shown up at that Klan rally could do anything for you at that time. And the ordinance, you know, municipal decree or regulation mandating something, you know, like you would say no smoking in this particular area, then these cities, as well as, well, the audience would apply to the cities just banning African Americans and black people. So it's like you put up the big band sign with a little, there's a red sign with a little line through it, and put a black face on it. That's about the gist of it. Okay, I'll mute my line and give the firefighter a chance. Thanks, guys.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery Four, a retired firefighter. Thank you for your patience, sir.
Yes, sir. I will continue with my thoughts on the organization of this practice. And it was before all of the modern day means of technology of communicating, you know, Twitter and Facebook and, you know, even telephones. They were invented, but it was still in a primitive stage. I doubt that it was a landline in everybody's home, but white people were so intent on to their practice of racism, white supremacy. Word of mouth was very well used. And I think that they were roaming groups of white people, quote unquote, Ku Klux Klan and such other organizations that are not as popular but just as effective in their means, because the methods were practiced everywhere, the same methods. It's a variety of them, but they were practiced in all of these different places. And there was different tactics and strategies. Well, okay, if the Negro does this, this is what we do, you know, that sort of thing. To whereas non-white black people were confined to the quote-unquote homes that white people wanted them to be in primarily. The only level of entrepreneurship was only on a very primitive level because they, I guess the white people stated that, okay, well, we're not going to no longer, as we did in the southern part of this part of the world, feed them. They, we'll just allow them to have to feed themselves and barter and trade with themselves until we get tired of it. And then we're going to destroy the whole environment, especially if we see that they are profiting at a more proficient rate than what we are, i.e. Tulsa, Oklahoma, and plenty other places that was taking place during that time. Last thought is that I think also from these readings, it kind of like puts away the whole idea of the institutionalized version of slavery is the ground of racism and white supremacy. Oh, the author is mentioning all of these places where that didn't exist. So that tells you that white people were motivated in a much more fundamental way on mistreating people based on color than just some form of institutionalized slavery. It was much more of a motivation than that, because these places didn't have that. You know, I'm hearing Wisconsin, Illinois. I'm hearing that in places where that didn't exist. So, and I'm just mentioning that because through my many years of conversations with primarily non-white black people, the subject matter of quote unquote slavery and racism, white supremacy comes up in the same, almost the same explanation, and I think is incorrect into stating so. Institutionalized slavery in this part of the world was just one of the examples examples even on a scientific level on how the system of racism, white supremacy was being practiced, I think. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Any other folks who dialed in have commentary that they wanted to share? We'll assume folks are good for the time being. *61, if you have comment, question, you want to make sure you share. We have about 5 minutes or so left in the broadcast. A few quick things I'll share at the beginning of the section, creating sundown towns by ordinance. He has the phrase specifically, a sense of terror. I'll give you the full, because he uses it a few times. He has that whites gained a sense of power from these public lynchings. And then subsequently, several crosses were burned in the areas where blacks lived in the city. The earlier sense of possibility for African-Americans in the Fond du Lac, the welcome meal, the rooms at the hotel described in the previous chapter, had been replaced by a sense of terror. That is not a sense of terror. That is terrorism. Again, minimizing. And whites don't have a sense of power. They have power to terrorize, rape, maim, pillage, you name it. Right on the same page, George Burr, a boot black in Oregon, no less, sleeping with a white woman, again, the man, not race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood, Dr. Tommy J. Curry. Let's see. And a very next section, creating sundown towns by freeze out, where David Roediger, he is a well-known white author, one of the academics who writes really scholarly articles and books about white supremacy, racism. But Mr. Roediger, he grew up in this, what they call sundown town in Illinois, and says that the police chief told his mother almost immediately, took her to the side to say that she should feel secure, unlike in Cairo, because Columbia had a 6 p.m. whistle to warn blacks out of town. Again, protecting, all of this done in the name of the white woman, the man, not race, class, genre, Tommy Curry. So right in the paragraph beneath that, where they talked about Jim Clayton, he's with the, retired from the Washington Post. An ordinance would be superfluous, he suggested. Everyone, whites, already knew no African Americans were allowed in town, so why bother saying so? White people cannot be ignorant about racism, white supremacy. And I just think sometimes those short snippets where it just talks about the collective knowledge, we don't have to be told. What do you mean white people don't understand racism, don't know what white supremacy racism is? Of course we know how to keep the niggers out. We don't need an ordinance. We don't need a law to tell us to keep the niggers out. Everybody already, it would be superfluous, redundant. I think that's a synonym, as they call it. Let's see. Nigger Ridge, I said that before. And even the point that he made previously about the town where they only had about 400 people. It's not like it was a bustling metropolis, but they still had an ordinance to keep out the Negroes. I think that's important because it seems that shame, that same collectivity of thought of we are united in racism, white supremacy, and we have our nigger codes on the books just like everywhere else. It doesn't matter if we think we'll actually ever see a nigger. We know what to do. We know we are committed to being racists, white supremacists. We know what that means, how that means we should be functioning even on the suspicion that a nigger might end up here. That doesn't mean that we don't love. They probably know where all of the best whorehouses are, where they can go and rape niggers every day, but we still get our ordinance. All 20 of us, no niggers will live here. I loved the portion about Wisconsin. So glad Rob got out of there. Where they talked about they had brief period of interracial cooperation. Race relations were good. They said the neighboring white school agreed to take in their children. And the years after the Civil War, Pleasant Ridge hosted an annual picnic, pick a nigger, that featured an agreeable mixing of the neighbors. But by the late 1880s, didn't last long. Its white neighbors had rechristened it Nigger Ridge. Now, in my view, it was probably Nigger Ridge the whole time. They just, you know, we can come play nice for the picnic, and then it's Nigger Ridge. Going to Nigger Ridge for the picnic, and then whenever they just got tired of it, it's, okay, we're not doing the picnic anymore, it's Nigger Ridge. The importance, I think, I had one more. Oh, yeah. At the end of the Creating Sundown Towns and Suburbs, excellent point. As Wendonette historian Edwina DeWitt points out, for such a crusade to succeed, the crusade, even the use of that word implying religion of white supremacy, but for such a crusade to succeed requires, and this is all in quotes, a general unity of action of all Wendat citizens in not renting or selling property to Negroes, refusing to serve them in stores and restaurants, and not hiring Negroes in places of employment. Now, that end quote. Such unanimity over time might require more widespread anti-black feeling, which Wendonite had in abundance, and more systemic discrimination than is manifested in a town where a mob suddenly erupts to force out African Americans overnight. One can certainly quibble with the point, but I certainly understand in terms of the amount of calm, not an outburst. This is not a drunken rage. This is calmly sitting down and planning all of the ordinances and codes and agreeing that we're not going to hire and we're not going to rent and all of the other coordination that it takes to plan this out as a town. This is going to be our town's code of how we violate and keep out the Negroes. That is very different than we drunk a little bit and there was a rumor that a Negro might have raped a white woman, so we're going to go out and shoot up and kill up the Negroes. Very, very different. You can, as I said, take whichever you want, but either way, the general point or the main important point, a general unity of action between whites about practicing racism, white supremacy. He makes that point repeatedly in this section this week. I thought that was extremely important, very accurate. Did I get all my notes? Got all my notes. Do we have any other folks? Or I guess if you have 60 seconds you have a final question, thought you need to get in 60 seconds, you can get it in before we wrap things up. Oh, folks are satisfied then. We'll be here for Workplace Racism tomorrow. That would be Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll review strategies, catch up with this week at the yoga studio. Wow. Even though that is not workplace racism, it is very close to policy and procedure. Very important. Your composure. Very important. Asking questions. Very, very important. 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Workplace Racism tomorrow and Saturday. Compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Much obliged for all the folks who tuned in. Hope it was worthy of your time and energy for a Thursday evening. Reading is more important than watching television. If you're listening to the archives, you can email and we will share your commentary as we proceed. Again, listen and read as though Mr. Lowen is listening to the book commentary so that we can have some instructive insight. Suspected race soldier, Mr. James Lowen. That's it. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. This here book, all the purging that is going on of black people. The terrorism continues in 2019. Let's make sure that we have our brain computer functioning at maximum efficiency in order to crank out solutions, concepts to permanently solve the problem. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we're in a vehicle, driver, or passenger. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.